the review is going to be very short and sweet. We still need to touch on chapter 11 because we did not quite get that covered last week. Leon, I'm borrowing your clicker here. I do like this one. That is not where it's supposed to start. I'm sorry. There we go. That's the beginning. Now, so here's our important dates. These are going to start getting a little more significant as we press forward, but everybody should have those. And then our three divisions of the book, predicting the fall of Jerusalem, and then we'll be talking about the other nations surrounding them. And then, of course, the book will end on the promises of the restoration. But all of these messages will be presenting the idea that they shall know that I am the Lord, and that is somewhat the unofficial theme of the book. We remember when we started the book, Ezekiel is presented with the throne of God, the chariot throne of God. It talked about the mobility of that chariot a lot. And then he's given the role of a watchman. And as we always ask, what is the role of a watchman? To warn, not to defend, not to save, to warn. Okay, so that's his job. His job is to warn them and let them know what is going on. He's then given the assignment to act out the siege of Jerusalem, building the model and laying on his side for 430 days total. So we know that probably got tedious at times, but that was what he is to do, to demonstrate the sin of both Israel and Judah. Then God gives justification for what he is doing, why he's doing the things, why these things are to come. And remember, he took Ezekiel to the temple and showed him the various abominations that were going on there, and the different things, you know, showing why, how far Jerusalem has driven itself away from God. And so that's where he's trying to let them know why he's doing the things he's doing, why they are receiving this judgment. And then we see the spiritual view, you know, kind of like in Revelation, you kind of get to see the spiritual side of things as opposed to the physical side of things. And so we see God calling out the men to go destroy the city. But of course, before that, he sends this, as we called him, the scribe, to go mark the ones that were actually upset about the situation, and were the faithful, to make it simpler. They are to go mark them, and then the other men are to go wipe out everyone that didn't have the mark, and of course set the city on fire. And then we do get a glimpse of hope that we have not quite seen the extent of before we get out of there. And then, as we'll talk about real quickly in chapter 11, the glory of God will depart. So very quickly, chapter 11, remember the God has mounted his chariot. He has come out from the temple, mounted his chariot, and has moved to the east gate. And so there, Ezekiel joins him, and they see, again, 25 men. And these are identified as leaders of Jerusalem, rulers of Jerusalem, and influencers, for lack of a better term. And God says they've been giving wicked counsel to the people. And I believe you see some of this in Jeremiah, but they're being told. Now, so what we're talking about here, it seems like these men have been writing letters to the captives. These are men in Jerusalem, possibly writing letters to the captives, just like Jeremiah did. And so they're writing to them, and they're saying, guys, don't settle down out there in Babylon. Don't build houses. Don't get set. Y'all are coming back soon. Don't worry about this. It's not going to last that long. And, of course, Jeremiah gives them very different counsel in Jeremiah 29, and we don't have time to go there. But he writes to them and says, write the opposite. You're going to be there a while. And so another saying that these guys are saying is it's like Jerusalem is the pot and we're the meat. Now, when we think of that immediately, we're thinking of being cooked, right? But that's not what he's talking about. We're talking about a preserving pot, possibly the predecessor of potted meat. You know, you put the meat in the pot, you cover it with salt or fats or something like that to get it sealed in order to preserve it. That's kind of what they're talking about. They're not talking about a cooking pot. They're talking about a preserving pot. And so they're saying that Jerusalem's the pot, we're the meat, we're going to be happy. Everything's going to be fine, we're going to be protected. We're going to be preserved. So me and the kids have been rewatching a lot of the Star Wars. We watched one of the recent ones, and in one of those movies, somebody gives some big long rant, and Luke Skywalker just stops and looks at him and says, every word of what you just said is wrong. And that's what God is telling these prophets. Every word of what you're just saying is wrong. And so that is not what's going to happen. You're going to be taken out of the pot. You're going to be destroyed. And this is not going to be a good thing for you. While Ezekiel's telling this story, we actually see that one of the people that were recognized along the 25, Pelatiah, he dies. And so this gets Ezekiel so upset that he starts to worry again about that remnant, about God destroying the remnant. And so he asks God about it. And, you know, a while ago, God almost kind of blows him off about that. He's like, no, I'm taking care of business here. But this time, God gives us a little more hope. He spends a little more time on the hope that is to come than he has up to this point. And so starting in verse 14, we start kind of seeing things, kind of having a light at the end of the tunnel. He says that he's a sanctuary to the scattered people, and he will bring them back, and he will cleanse the land, and he will give them a heart of flesh. He's talking about their heart of stone. He's going to take that heart of stone out. He's going to give them a heart of flesh. And then he repeats the covenant that we've seen throughout Scripture, that they will be his people, and he will be his God. And so we see that hope coming. And so once that's declared, we now see the chariot depart the city and go and settle on the Mount of Olives, which is an observing point for Jerusalem. We see a lot of pictures of Jerusalem taken from that vantage point. And so, but I think the significant thing is the glory of God has now left the city and is now sitting outside the city. All right, so that being said, we will very quickly try to go over the questions. And Cheryl, where did we get to? Kathy? Okay, all right, so that'll bring me over to Wes. And so we'll go back. Mom and Dad, either one of y'all got number one ready? Yes. Okay, and that will put us right around 592 BC when you line that up with the other things. But yeah, the dates is what I was looking for. What you said was what I was looking for. All right, Mom? Yes. All right, Sandy, you got number three? Right, the glory of God, yes. All right, Miss Cindy? Yes, the horrible abominations ahead. All right, number five, Stanley.
What was the men doing in chapter 8, verse 15? They were worshiping the sun for the heat.
Okay, and there's another one of my typos. That was actually verse 16, but I guess y'all figured that out. all right, number six, Vicki. Yes. All right. Number seven.
What instructions were given in the nine pillars? Go to the midst of Jerusalem and put a mark on the foreheads of men who sign and cry for all the abominations that are done within it.
Yes. Number eight.
What was Ezekiel's concern that God was
Correct. All right, number 9.
What does Ezekiel see again, chapter 10, verses 1 through 2? A sapphire stone was in the throne, a man clothed in linen, was to scatter coals to the fire of the city.
All right, yeah, our throne chariot that we saw in chapter 1. All right, number 10. Yes, ma'am. That's correct. All right, number 11. Yes, that is correct. All right, number 12. Yes. All right, number 13. Whoever's got it back. Don't have it. All right, back over here. Brady, you got that one?
13.
Yes, sir. Okay. All right, we'll sum it up with the faithful people with a new spirit, a new heart, a heart of flesh. Basically, his people will be the ones that restore the land. All right, so now we'll move on to our next lesson, and I'm going to try to cover these next 8 chapters today, and you know, if I don't make it, I don't make it, but we'll try. So, but we are going to be moving very, very quickly. All right, so this section of Ezekiel, God through Ezekiel is just kind of giving some various warnings. We're going to have a few parables in there. It's kind of a mix and match type section. And just kind of think of it like, you know, a preacher, sometimes like Leon right now is kind of somewhat doing a series or has a structure, but then sometimes preachers just preach what they need to preach for that particular week. You know, there's no necessarily connection between one sermon to the next sermon. And that's kind of the way I see what's going on with Ezekiel right here. He would just have various sermons, and they may be an acting out. They may be a parable or whatever might be going on, but we've got different things going. And so that's why we're kind of trying to lump those together in this section here, because there's not a whole lot of a flow necessarily, but it's just different kind of episodes or sermons, as you will. So in chapter 12, we see Ezekiel's giving another acting job to do here. And so what he does is he gets all of his stuff together during the day, gets it out ready to move, and then at night he goes and digs into the wall and like he's going to escape, and he's covering his face as he's doing this, and so it's kind of being sneaky and everything like that. One thing I do want to do is to actually read Jeremiah chapter 39 real quickly. Jeremiah 39, and I want to read verses 1 through 7 and see if what we just talked about sounds somewhat familiar. So Jeremiah 39, starting in verse 1. In the ninth year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the tenth month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all of his army came against Jerusalem and besieged it. Now remember, in Ezekiel, this has not happened yet. In Ezekiel, we're not here historically yet. All right? In the 11th year of Zedekiah, in the fourth month, on the ninth day of the month, the city was penetrated. Then all the princes of the king of Babylon came in and sat in the middle gate, and I'm going to have to just skip these names for now, skip down to verse 4. So it was when Zedekiah, the king of Judah, and all the men of the war saw them, they fled and went out of the city by night by way of the king's garden and by the gate between the two walks, and he went out by the way of the plain. But the Chaldean army pursued them and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho, and when they had captured him, they brought him up to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, to Riblah in the land of Hamath. There he pronounced judgment on him. Then the king of Babylon killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes in Riblah, and the king of Babylon also killed the nobles of Judah. Moreover, he put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him with the bronze fetters to carry him off to Babylon. So here we have the scene of Zedekiah trying to flee, trying to get away from the siege once the city had been breached. And so this is what God through Ezekiel is predicting at this point, is what's going to happen to Zedekiah. He's going to try to escape. He's going to try to slip through a crack in the wall, but yet he's still going to be caught and captured. And, you know, the covering of his eyes could represent the blindness that he received. It could represent just him trying to hide, being slip out. But whatever the case is, this is what God is trying to get across in this particular section, is the fact that Zedekiah, who remember is the puppet king sitting in Jerusalem right now, as we're studying, he will be captured and he will be deported. And so we keep that story in mind as we hit a few more of these things going along. So now in verse 16, everybody look at verse 16. What will they understand when this happens? They will know I am the Lord. All right? So now in 17 through 20, Ezekiel is told to eat and drink in anxiety. And we're kind of going to see why in the following verses. But so when you eat and drink, you know, you ever seen anybody that's so nervous when they try to drink, you know, their cup's shaking and they almost spill things or their forks? You know, that's kind of what I see Ezekiel representing here when he's doing this. And so then in 21, going through the rest of the chapter, we see what the people have been thinking. They're saying, okay, we've been hearing this a long time and it's not happening. And so when prophecies, you know, these prophecies are worthless because we've been so long and they just have not happened. But God's letting them know, well, I'm done postponing. It's time. And in fact, he even brings, in verse 25, he mentions the fact that this is going to happen in your days. You know, they've been hearing these warnings for generations because of God's long suffering, right? And so, but he's like, nope, it's happening in your days. This is not to be put off anymore. It's time for you to be nervous while you're eating. It's time for you to start having dread. And so the postponement is done. I'm finished. It's time. No reason to be thinking that these prophecies aren't going to happen, because it's about to start happening. All right? Breath. For me, anyway. All right. So now, in chapter 13, God now is, well, you know what? I had a slide there, but I don't know how much it helps you. But anyway, there's a picture of him acting out the capture of Zedekiah. All right, so now, chapter 13. God now issues a woe to the foolish prophets. And these are prophets that are prophesying from their own standpoint. They're not prophesying from God. They're not giving God's word. They're doing their own. And so because of that, God pronounces in verse 9, he says, they will not be in the assembly of my people, nor be written in the record, nor shall they enter the land. Then you shall know that I am the Lord. All right? So we don't have any books of the Bible named after these guys, do we? Their prophecies are not written because they're not true. They're written from their own heart. And so starting in verse 10, we hear the idea about how they're saying, you know, peace, peace, when there is no peace. We've heard that phrase thrown out quite a bit. And so what they're doing, they're building a weak wall of defense. You know, as they're trying to defend the people, their wall, one version says has untempered mortar. Others say that it's just a whitewashed wall. So, I mean, there's no structure there. It's just painted over, covered over. And so, you know, in contrast to the other prophets that have stood in the gaps of the walls at times and different things like that, doing whatever they could to defend, these folks are doing right the opposite. They're building a weak wall that cannot stand up to pressure. And so what God says he's going to do is he's going to apply the pressure. And of course, their wall is going to crack. Their wall is going to fall. It's not going to be there. And so he's going to send the storm is the language that he uses. He's going to send the storm against it, and that will cause the wall to fall. In the second half of the chapter, he pronounces judgment against the women who practice divination and sorcery and those type of things. And he pictures them as preying upon the people and taking advantage of them. And he says that what they're doing is strengthening the wicked, giving encouragement to the wicked, and weakening the righteous. And so he lets them know that he will deliver the people out of their hands, and he's going to take care, and they're going to stop. And of course, what will they know? That I am the Lord. All right? We cover that quick enough for you? all right. So now, that brings us on to chapter 14. So in chapter 14, we have a group of elders that come to Ezekiel. But God points out their hypocrisy right at the beginning. He says, yeah, they're coming to you, but they've got idols in their heart. That's where their devotion is. Their devotion is to the heart. They're just wanting you to come tell them everything's okay. And of course, they have the idols in their heart, but yet they want to come to God and ask, you know, they want to be told what is, they want to be told that what they're doing is okay. They want to be told that everything's going to be fine. You remember, I mean, that's the common theme. They all think they're going back to Jerusalem pretty soon, right? So that's what they're coming. They're wanting to hear this. But God says, he says, really? They're coming to question me? I tell you what, I'll answer them myself. I don't need the prophets to help me with this. I'm going to answer them myself. I'm the one that's going to give them the answer. And in verse 5, he mentions that I'm going to seize them by their heart. He wants to make sure that what is said is as effective as possible. He wants to seize them by their heart. And because he wants them to change, doesn't he? He wants them. He wants them back. He's not wanting to exact this wrath upon them, but he's going to take it upon himself. And so in verse 9 through 11, he gives kind of a warning to these prophets. He lets them know. He says, I don't need you to tell you, for you to tell what you think. I need you to tell what I need to be the one speaking to them and not you. And so, you know, they may be gaining this popularity because everybody's coming to them. And have you ever seen a situation where somebody just tells people what they want to hear and they gain a lot of big following? I mean, that happens all the time, doesn't it? And then the guy over there telling the truth doesn't always have very much listening to him. And so I think that's kind of what's happening here. They're going, they're wanting to hear, or they want to go, they want to hear what they want to hear and not what they need to hear. And of course, God is saying that that's not going to help them. That's not where he needs to be. And then again, he says that he wants to handle it because he wants to be their God. He wants them to be his people. All right. So now we're kind of going to a little bit different prophecy starting in verse 12. He mentions the fact that when sin persists in a nation or a land, when it just keeps on, when the sin just continues and it just keeps going and keeps going and keeps going, that there's not a lot that's going to help. At that point, they reach a point of no return. And so it says that once the land persists in sin, God will stretch out his hand against it. And we see different woes being mentioned here. We see famine being mentioned. We see a wild beast. The sword, which is military oppression, right? Or persecution. And then finally, pestilence. And so he says, you know what? Even if Noah was in that city, it wouldn't be enough. Noah could save himself, but it wouldn't be enough. He mentions Daniel. We're pretty confident it's the Daniel we're thinking. Maybe not 100% confident, but we're pretty confident. Daniel's been there about 12, 14 years at this point. So he's probably got a reputation, and I'm sure the captives know who he is. Because he's in Babylon, and I guarantee you he's, you know, helped them out here and there. I guarantee you they know who he is. But so we're pretty confident that this is the same Daniel. And then what about Job? Could Job make God change his mind? I mean, not even Job. I mean, so, and just as kind of an aside here, wouldn't it feel good to be in this list? And I mean, and Daniel's still alive. So if he got to read this, wouldn't that make him feel good, you know, if he was there? But yeah, to be able to be in that list is, you know, now granted, the point of the list is futility. But God's the one making it. So not even these guys could make a difference. And I think it's important to note, we've seen men make a difference in God's mind, haven't we? We've seen Moses do it. Do what? Yes, Hezekiah changes his mind about Hezekiah's life, yes. But the point here is the persistence of sin. It's the idea that, you know, Israel has continued to do this over, you know, getting close to 1,000 years, if I got my brain on right. So it's just they've constantly had this persistence. And so I think the idea is God can change his mind, and God, you know, men can influence him. But we reach that point to where not even these influential men can make the difference. And so I think that's something we need to kind of keep in mind too, as a church, as a family, as a church, as a nation. You know, that persistence is going to get us to a point that's not going to be easy to get out of. So, but anyway, so that's, it's going to be hard for God to change his mind at this point. Go ahead.
So what you said, I was thinking about the other day. Individuals can change their mind. I don't, in my mind, I can't think of any history where a nation has ever changed direction like that. They've gone to the right. Once they've gone so far, it's just on until destruction.
Yeah, once they've reached a point, I mean, we know that the city of Nineveh changed and postponed their judgment for a while. Well, and even Judah got postponed, you know, thanks to Josiah and different people like that. But once a nation has reached a certain point, and this is the only time we've really seen God just say, I'm done. And we've reached that point. And so it's going to take, well, there's nothing at this point. God has declared this is going to happen. And as we will discuss going forward, that this is not excluding individuals' ability to change and make a difference. We'll hit that a little bit, but we're talking about from a national standpoint here, or in this case, a city. Leon?
Related passage, 2 Chronicles 36:16. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's a great another way of putting it. Yeah, that raising his wrath to a point to where there is no remedy. Yeah. All right. But now again, verse 21, we still get those little nuggets all through this, right? So we still get the little nuggets of a remnant, but and this one is just a nugget. But we see that there's going to be a remnant that gets to come. And so there's kind of, some people see it one way, some people see another. We see that there's some people that think, you know, that the faithfulness of this remnant when they come to Babylon, because they, you know, the remnant will be brought to Babylon even after this point, that will help them see that, you know, what God's doing is justified. Others are saying that the remnant is still pretty, you know, even the ones coming out are so bad that they're going to understand. But whatever the case is what they see from this remnant, they will understand that God has been justified in what he has been doing. And so it's just kind of a, a scene there where they see them coming out, they see their attitudes, they see their behaviors, and they know, okay, God did this for a reason, and we understand it. He wasn't just acting out of unjustified anger. All right? So now, chapter 15 is a very short chapter. We have a parable about a vine, and so what I'm seeing here is, you know, a vine that's useful has fruit, right? Well, so when I hear this, it says that it's a vine from the woods. Now, all the vines I ever see in the woods are pretty useless. They just grow up a tree. They're a parasite. And so they're pretty useless to begin with. About the only thing you can do with them is throw them in the fire. And that's what God is showing here. This is a vine that's worth nothing. You can't make anything out of the wood. You can't even make a peg. And so you take it, you throw it in the fire, and after it's been burned, it's even more useless. And so I think that's kind of the comparison that God is using here with the folks in Jerusalem. And so I don't think I would want to be thrown in that lump with that comparison. But, all right, so that's about all I have to say on 15. I will open this one up. Somebody that has a comment real quick on that. But I think the message here is pretty simple. All right. Now, chapter 16. Now, it's pretty interesting parallel that's thrown here. So what we get is, you know, we're talking about Jerusalem. And so it talks about the city. It personifies the city as a baby being born, and the baby's just left out, completely abandoned, just out in the wild. Nobody's helping it out at all. It's in a really bad state. And so when you look at the history of Jerusalem, you understand, you know, that Jerusalem had always been inhabited by pagan nations, these other nations, Hittites, Amorites, different ones like that. And until the time of David, it never was under Israelite rule. And so, you know, Jerusalem was really nothing to talk about until God gets a hold of it. And once God gets a hold of it, then you have this little filthy, wallowing baby that becomes a beautiful woman. And under God's care, under God's help, becomes a great woman. Has all the jewelry she needs, everything, all the influence she needs, all the clothing, shelter, everything about her is great, to the point of opulence. And so when we get to this point, I'm thinking of the times of David and Solomon. Think of the greatness of Jerusalem during the time of David and Solomon. And so, you know, so now, thanks to God, she has everything. She's in great shape. She's in a great position, and everything is good. But then, getting around verse 15, we see that she starts to trust in her own beauty. She starts to trust in herself, all right? And because of that, she begins to play the harlot. And so we go into great detail about this harlotry that she commits. And it says that she, you know, she gives herself to Egypt. She gives her, you know, the gods of Egypt. We see her giving herself to the gods of the Philistines, the Assyrians, and the Chaldeans. Now, who are the Chaldeans?
Babylon.
Okay. So we see her giving herself to all these. And so I did want to read verse 30, chapter 16 and verse 30. We see to the point to which she has reached. How degenerate is your heart, says the Lord God, seeing you do all these things, the deeds of a brazen harlot. So there is nothing held back from God's description of her harlotry. It's and if you read the whole thing, it just kind of hit me how graphic and how bad it has gotten. And so we see that she has gotten to the point to where, you know, when we're talking about a harlot, we're talking about someone who receives payment for herself, right? She is so bad, she's paying them. Says, you're the opposite. You're paying them to give yourself to them. And so, and he talks about how just the word degenerate just keeps coming up. How bad, how horrible it has gotten to this point. And so once we get to verse 35, we start seeing that now these lovers that she has been paying start to abuse her and start to do her wrong and treat her bad and all these different things. And so as the worst, and I mean, as it goes, it just gets to the point finally she's finally having to stop, because I mean all these things have been coming against her. And and of course we know at this point in time the Babylonians are the ones that's taking care of that abuse that's happening at this moment. And so she will be driven to a point of having to stop. She's not going to have a choice. And so that gets us down to verse 44. If anybody has a quick comment, I'll take it. But otherwise, we'll just keep trucking. All right. So now we get down to about verse 44. We're still kind of in that same parallel, but we're shifting gears just slightly. He now compares Jerusalem to her sisters. All right, so her sisters are Samaria and Sodom. All right, so when we're talking about Samaria, what are we talking about? Yeah, Israel. Remember, that was Israel's, the northern kingdom's capital. And what situation are they in right now? Yeah, they're gone. They've already been taken care of. They've already been judged. And so, you know, Judah's probably been pretty smug about them up to this point, right? And we know the story of Sodom a long, long time ago, how they were destroyed. So so Jerusalem is compared to her sisters. And if you've read ahead, how do they compare? How is Jerusalem compared to Sodom and Samaria? They're worse. They're considered worse than Sodom and Samaria. Now, you can't slap a Jew harder in the face than that statement, can you? So, he is letting them know how bad they have gotten. And so, it even mentions the fact that, you know, Sodom had become a byword to them. And we know that it kind of is to us too, right? I mean, we use it in our language of sodomy, you know, as a, you know, the name of a crime. And so that's how bad that you know, that they're worse than that is an ultimate slap in the face. But yet we get on down to verse 60, and God lets them know that even so, he's still going to remember his covenant. He's still going to remember his covenant from her youth. And not only that, he's going to establish an everlasting one. And do we see anything messianic in here? We kind of see some idea, you know, that then now we have an everlasting. What was the original covenant with Jerusalem? Do what? I can't hear, I'm sorry. Not quite. With Jerusalem. Think of Jerusalem. Do what? Okay. But what was in Jerusalem? The throne. Right? So what was a promise that was supposed to...
Start off, would always be there.
Remember, he promised David. You always have a man on the throne. So that was the one that I feel like he's saying that he would remember from her youth. And now this everlasting one kind of ties on to it. Jesus will become that everlasting one on the throne. And so anyway, I think that's kind of where he's going with that. I could be mistaken, but that's kind of the way I'm seeing it. But yes, but even, I just find it interesting that how, especially if you read this chapter, how ugly this picture gets, but yet God still finds time to mention the hope and give that little glimmer of hope just every time it pops up. All right? All right, so we've got just a few more minutes, so let's kind of keep trucking. All right, chapter 17, even I know we're close on time, but I do want to read the first 10 verses of chapter 17. And the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, pose a riddle, and and speak a parable to the house of Israel, and say, Thus says the Lord, A great eagle with large wings and long pinions, full of feathers of various colors, came to Lebanon and took from the cedar the highest branch. He cropped off its topmost young twig and carried it to a land of trade. He set it in a city of merchants. Then he took some of the seed of the land and planted it in a fertile field. He placed it by abundant waters and set it like a willow tree. And it grew and became a spreading vine of low stature. Its branches turned toward him, but its roots were under it. So it became a vine and brought forth branches and put forth shoots. But there was another great eagle with large wings and many feathers. And behold, this vine bent its roots toward him and stretched its branches toward him from the garden terrace where it had been planted that he might water it. It was planted in good soil by many waters to bring forth branches and bear fruit and become a majestic vine. Say, thus saith the Lord, will it thrive? Will he not pull up its roots, cut off its fruit, and leave it to wither? All of its spring leaves will wither, and no great power or many people will need to pluck it up by its roots. Behold, it is planted. Will it thrive? Will it not utterly wither when the east wind touches it? Will it wither the garden terrace where it grew? Since we're about to run out of time, this is a parallel telling again about how the kings of Judah have been treated as far as their captivity. And so we see that when the eagle comes and gets the twig, we're talking about King Jehoiachin being carried off to Babylon and Zedekiah being put in as the puppet king. But the problem is Zedekiah does not recognize this as God's judgment and tries to rebel against it. And so he teams up with Egypt. That's going toward the new eagle. You know, the first eagle is Nebuchadnezzar. The next eagle is Egypt. And so doing that and not accepting God's plan as it was, that sets his doom into place. And so Zedekiah will be plucked up and the vine will wither from that point. But then at the end of verse 17, I don't want to miss that. It says, God will take a twig and he will plant it on a mountain. And it will become great and all types of birds will be able to dwell within that tree. And so we kind of see that similar language as we saw in, as we see in Daniel, you know, with that kingdom being planted and growing in and all the nations being blessed. And so we can see the messianic promise in there. In verse 24, it says, And all the trees of the field shall know that I, the Lord, have brought down the high tree and exalted the low tree, dried up the green tree and made the dry tree flourish. I, the Lord, have spoken and have done it. So that's the idea given in chapter 17. If you can give me about 1 minute, Keith. Well, you've rang the bell, but that's fine. Chapter 18, we're familiar with chapter 18. That's one that we study quite a bit. We get the parables or the proverb about eating sour grapes, the father eating sour grapes, and the son's teeth being set on the edge. And so, but God spends this whole chapter refuting that proverb and saying, what you do will be your consequences, not your father's. And what your father does will not affect you. Everyone is accountable for their actions. And if you need just a good summary statement of the chapter, read verses 30 and through 32. And that sums up the idea of the chapter. What we're going to call chapter 19 done. So chapter 19 is a poetic lament about the kings of Judah. We have a lioness that has two cubs. These two cubs are represented of King Jehoahaz, who gets taken away to Egypt. And of course, Jehoiachin, who gets taken away to Babylon. And if you read that, you'll see that parallel that's happening there. And then you get a real similar concept with a vine at the end of that chapter. All right, I'm going to call chapter 19 done. And teacher's prerogative, right?